Welcome to another edition of the Student Press Law Center podcast. I'm Frank Lamani, Executive Director of the Student Press Law Center. The SPLC is an advocate for the rights of student journalists in K-12 schools and colleges, and we maintain a library of resources of use to those working in the student media online at www.splc.org. This is an unusually active time for student free speech rights. As we're recording this podcast, John and Mary Beth Tinker of the famous Supreme Court Tinker case are winding down a week of commemorative activities in Des Moines, Iowa, marking the 50th anniversary of their anti-war protest, which led to the landmark Tinker Supreme Court decision. Even as that is going on, petitions are being filed with the U.S. Supreme Court to review a case called Taylor Bell versus Itawamba School Board. In that case, the court is being asked for the first time to determine what the extent of schools' disciplinary authority might be over student speech that is posted on social media when they are off campus on their personal time. And finally, up against all of that, a movement called New Voices is taking shape around the country, partly under the sponsorship and guidance of the Student Press Law Center, to enact state laws that reverse the impact of the Supreme Court's Hazelwood versus Kuhlmeier decision and that restore some balance to the governance of student media. More information about that campaign is available at newvoicesus.com. Our guest today, Professor Catherine Ross, has a very timely new book out entitled Lessons in Censorship. Professor Ross is with the George Washington University School of Law, and where she specializes in constitutional rights. She has 3 degrees from Yale University, including her law degree. She was employed there as a professor prior to law school. She is a very widely quoted and published expert on the constitutional rights of young people, which has been an area of specialty for her. And we are so thankful to her for joining us and for publishing this really valuable new work that sheds light on the state of student First Amendment rights and how they might be deficient and how they might be improved. So, Professor Ross, with that, thanks again for joining us, and please start us off by just describing the premise of your book, Lessons in Censorship, and where your interest in this subject of student free expression rights comes from.
Thanks, Frank. It's really a pleasure to be here with your audience and with you. The book is really at the intersection of my two longstanding scholarly passions, the First Amendment and the rights of minors. And at an emotional level, I should also say my father came here with his family as a teenager fleeing the Nazis, and he often talked about the day he became a U.S. citizen and how moving it was, and he really took the promise of America very seriously, and of the freedoms that we get here that he had not had before. And I really absorbed that as at a young age, at a very primal level. But the First Amendment is really the key to liberty and democracy, because if we don't have free expression, we don't know our rights, we don't know when they're being violated, we can't dissent, and we can't demand change. Justice Brandeis said the founders believed that liberty was the secret of happiness, and that courage is the secret of liberty. And so to be happy as a human being, to have fully developed sense of who you are in the world, you need information and you need the right to make choices and to be different from other people, to not be a conformist. And it takes some courage to stand up and use your First Amendment rights, as high school students and younger are showing us every day when they fight for their First Amendment rights. So the premise of my book is that schools have abandoned one of the functions that we as a democracy have long counted on them to perform, which is to train students in the meaning of democracy, including the meaning of the rights guaranteed by the Constitution, to learn why those rights matter and how to exercise them responsibly. And one of the ways that you learn to do that is by experiencing them and living them in school. We have to remember that schools are the government institution that has the most contact with average citizens, next perhaps to traffic court. Between 85% and 90% of our children go to public school, And this is our opportunity as a society to inculcate them in the values of democracy, including the First Amendment. So I think that beside the precise focus of my book on speech rights in schools, my book is also about the peril to democracy if we don't raise citizens who understand rights and what's at stake. And unfortunately, we do. The opening vignette of my book involves a girl who was handing out leaflets in front of the school, and one of the ironies is she was handing out leaflets to protest the fact that one of her friends had been suspended for making a video opposed to bullying. I'm going to repeat that, opposed to bullying. But she was suspended because a parent complained, and which is often what happens. The friend who's leafleting was stopped by a school official who said, and I quote, "You lose all constitutional rights when you enter a school building."
Right.
Nothing could be further from the truth. We have more than half a century of Supreme Court decisions saying that you absolutely have rights when you enter a school building, whether you're a student or a teacher. And our focus, of course, is on children. That quote also suggests to me, and I can say this in an informal setting like this conversation, though I don't say it in the book where I'm a little bit more lawyerly, the idea that you lose all constitutional rights when you enter a school building, to me, is quite reminiscent of the sign or the statement about Dante's entrance to hell. Lose all hope, ye who enter here. And unfortunately, that's how a lot of kids these days feel about school and many of its aspects. So part of my book is to show the rampant violations of student speech rights and why they matter. But I try not to be just in the posture of a critic and a finger pointer, because I'm also very sensitive to the fact that educators need to be sure that students learn in school. They need a certain degree of discipline and decorum. They need to protect students from what Justice Breyer once said is a potentially dangerous environment. Kids have no choice. They have to be in school. So I'm sensitive to some of the reasons for the violation of speech rights. One is that the law in the area is very complex, very fragmented, and often hard to understand and apply. And one of the problems is that trial court judges often throw up their hands, and even appellate court judges, and they say, oh, this is such a complicated area of law. How am I supposed to know? Well, if judges are saying that, we can't really expect a school principal who's not a lawyer to be fully on top of all the nuances. So some educators are justifiably confused.
With regard to your observation about the way that lower courts interpret the First Amendment in schools, we've always been told in the law of the First Amendment that if the law is unclear and if there is a close judgment call to be made, then the benefit of that lack of clarity must always go to the speaker. That if the speaker could not figure out in an exercise of reasonable judgment whether their speech was or was not protected by the Constitution, then that's the answer. The answer is that it is protected because there was a lack of clarity. And yet, when the regulator is a school and when the speaker is a student, it seems quite commonplace now for all of the benefit of the doubt to go to the government regulator, which is quite different from the First Amendment doctrine any place else outside of a school.
That is a terrific point, Frank. In the school, that idea is turned on its head and the benefit goes to the administrator. Even if the court says this was a violation of the student's rights and we're going to grant the student some relief, like expunging the disciplinary sanctions from the student's permanent record, which is one of the major reasons that students go to court, but we're not going to really hold the school principal accountable because there was never a set of facts that looked exactly like this. And so we're not going to expect them to be able to extrapolate from the general doctrine and the principles in the law. And I take the view that we should be able to understand what the meaning of the law is and what it is trying to accomplish in terms of speech rights, even in schools. So even when the law is clear, though, we find that sometimes administrators just overlook it. So let me just say a couple of things about the current state of the law for listeners who may not be following your podcasts every single month, although I know that many people follow them religiously. Where the law is clear, okay, here is sort of the, you know, quick and dirty. If it's personal or what I call pure student speech governed by the famous case of Tinker versus Des Moines, the school cannot censor it unless the school reasonably anticipates that the speech will cause material disruption of the educational function of the school. And then the court subsequently carved out some exceptions. The first is really not, doesn't come up that commonly because the school just about always wins. The school has the right to censor and discipline lewd speech, but it has to have sexual overtones. And there, the point is that the school can teach civilized manner of speech, but it can't censor the ideas. The biggest exception, of course, is Hazelwood v. Kollmeyer, which involved a student newspaper that was done as part of a class for credit. But the court went far beyond what happens under close supervision and said that where the speech is school-sponsored, in other words, it appears to have the school's imprimatur, or as Justice Alito once put it very clearly, it appears to be the school's own speech, then the school can censor it at its discretion for any legitimate pedagogical reason. But schools of almost always win when this is the legal standard, but there are two important arguments that can be made that perhaps aren't made often enough. It must appear to be the school's own expression, and they have to have a reason besides the fact that they don't like the idea, except in a couple of parts of the country where the appellate courts have said that schools can discriminate based on viewpoint when applying this kind of censorship. And finally, and the most recent case, the court said that the schools can censor speech that appears to promote the use of illegal substances, like drugs, unless the speech is political. So one of the things my book does is first explain the law where it's clear, where the Supreme Court has not resolved an important issue on which the lower courts are divided, and I try to identify those questions and issues. And then I try to propose a solution that's in keeping with the First Amendment goals of Tinker and the cases subsequent to Tinker that will bring some coherence to this area of law so that principals will no longer be able to say, I had no idea.
Well, probably the single biggest issue making its way through the federal courts right now, one that I touched on in the opening in reference to the Taylor Bell case, is the extent of schools' or colleges' punitive authority over off-campus internet speech on social media. That is, speech not created using school devices or school time. And I'm wondering, from your perspective, where is the proper line? Where should schools' punitive authority begin and end?
Great. This should be a really simple question, but like so many things in this area, turns out not to be. Let me here divide very clearly the K through 12 students from the university students. University students are adults, and their off-campus activity should be fully protected unless there's some kind of contractual arrangement or notice. You know, I don't know whether as a contractual matter a school might be able to say, if you get this kind of scholarship, we expect a certain level of behavior from you wherever you are, because the scholarship is a privilege, but being kicked out of college for speech that's protected on the internet seems really out of bounds. It's a bit more complicated and intellectually very interesting when we get to the K through 12 schools, students. And you're right that schools have increasingly been asserting authority to discipline students for what they say off campus, and often that takes place online. And sometimes they do that in response to directives from the state legislature, where there are statutes that say the schools have to take care of people who bully each other, even if the bullying occurs off campus. Well, that's a violation of the First Amendment, but it's also a statute. And so the educators feel a little bit stuck between a rock and a hard place, and those statutes should be challenged in court. So if we go back to the rationale of the Tinker case, which first said there's a lower or easier to satisfy standard for inhibitions on student speech, we have to think about the basic premise for having a special set of rules in K through 12. And the court's reasoning was that there is something unique about schools that isn't true in the rest of the world. And one of the things is students have to be there, as I said before, because of compulsory schooling laws. But also the court talked about the special environment of the school and the special mission that was entrusted to public schools. So the special environment is, in order for the activity that's going on there, which is serving an important government function, to proceed successfully, there has to be a certain level of order. And unlike other environments, people can't just walk away. They have to stay there. They have to do the work of the school. But equally important, the court said, is the role of the school in training citizens for life as in a democracy. And that requires open discussion. People have to get used to the marketplace of ideas. But there has to be a line that can't be crossed because of the school's special environment. And that line has nothing to do with the ideas being expressed, that they might upset another student. It is only when the words of the speaker are such that the school has evidence or reasonable basis to say, we're afraid this will prove materially disruptive, so we can't perform our educative function. And so if that's the reason for giving students less speech rights in school than outside of it, it clearly doesn't apply to the speech that the students are using outside of school. And we have another concern with minors, which is their parents also have authority over students. So there's the part of the day when students are in school and they're subject to the authority of the state, and there's the part of the day when they are at home or not in school, wherever they are, and subject to the parents' authority unless they violate the law, in which case they can be taken to court as, you know, juvenile delinquents or status offenders. So that was always a very clear division. And the Supreme Court has not weighed in on this. The lower courts are a bit divided, but none of them take the viewpoint that any student speech off campus is subject to discipline as if it occurred on campus. The most the courts are prepared to say is if the speech appears to be aimed at the school, if there's a close link between the speech and the school, and there's going to be a likelihood of material disruption under a very strong level of evidence of that, perhaps even higher in some circuits than would apply in school, then perhaps the school can discipline. And the test would be Tinker, which is the test that is most supportive of student speech, and that still has to be resolved. You mentioned the Bell case, which is very interesting, because in Bell, which some people have said stands for the principle that schools can regulate off-campus speech, I think it's a little more complicated because the appellate court sitting in bank and reversing the two decisions before it said that they thought that Bell's speech amounted to a true threat. And true threats are not protected by the Constitution, by the First Amendment. They are a very special and very small group of cases that lose their First Amendment protection because the harm is so identifiable.
That would be certainly the most glass half full way to read that case from a student rights perspective, is to say that it came out as it did, that is a finding that the school could discipline this student rapper for his off-campus video because it contained such explicit references to violence involving particular targeted individuals. What one might hope lower courts would take away from that case, rather than an open invitation to police all social media speech as if it were taking place on campus. Well, our guest is Professor Catherine Ross, the author of Lessons in Censorship. And just with the couple of minutes that we have remaining, Professor, I did want you to take a crack at what is going on college campuses these days. We've just been through a series of protests on college campuses, chiefly at the University of Missouri, where we saw actual students getting involved in trying to restrain media coverage of protests, and Missouri's case aided by some very vocal faculty members. There have been a number of colleges around the country where there has been pressure brought to bear by students to defund student media publications that they find offensive to them. There seems to be kind of a moment here in history where free speech is not especially popular on college campuses, and this pressure is coming from all ideological viewpoints. There's no monopoly on the left or the right. What is going on college campuses, and do you see a way clear of it?
Well, there are two parts to that question. The first is, I think, a big part of the problem is they didn't learn about freedom of speech and the fact that we all take the risk of being exposed to views that we don't like. That's part of the marketplace of ideas. Schools have been far too aggressive in trying to protect the most sensitive and to say if it's controversial or unpleasant or it's not tolerant, then you can't do it at school. And, you know, part of the problem with being a pluralist democracy is that even the intolerant have rights.
Sure.
They are making a political statement. It may not be the one that you and I like, but they have a right to make it. So the students have been protected from that. They haven't learned the reasons why we need to allow controversy. And they have been too accustomed to both administrators and parents coming into school and complaining and saying, that T-shirt offends me, the slogan on it is horrible, tell that kid to take it off. And the principal, taking a very short-sighted view of an immediate problem, says, take the T-shirt off, instead of saying,
right,
I'm sorry, the kid has a right to wear it. And maybe then having an assembly and explaining to everybody why people get to wear slogans that we might not like. So they come to college and they don't really know enough about this. And I think that's a huge problem. And then college administrators also have some blame to bear, because instead of saying, well, here are the demands that we can discuss with you without a risk of violating the First Amendment, which are many,
they back off. And thank Professor Ross and encourage everyone to look up her book, Lessons in Censorship, just published by Harvard University Press. And for those with more questions about the Bell case or any issue involving the First Amendment rights of students, please join us next month on the SPLC podcast, and do visit the SPLC.org website if you've got a legal question or concern or need help protecting your own First Amendment rights. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next month. Thank you.